Welcome you to session three. Treasury and the IRS are here to help. How does that happen? My name is Justin Miller. I'm going to serve as moderator for this esteemed panel. I'm delighted to introduce our special guest speaker, sort of two over to the left of me, Carlene Lesho. She is with the Internal Revenue Service IRS Office of Chief Counsel. All our speakers are special, but she's a special guest of ACTEC. Also joining me today to my immediate left, Kathy Hughes, home based in North Bethesda, Maryland. And at the far end, we have Beth Shapiro Kaufman from Washington, D.C. We have a pretty a robust agenda here. If you have questions, please, if you could hold them to the end, we're going to try to save some time. We also have a break at the end so to take questions. And with that, I'm going to kick it off. Before we jump into the substantive part, we do have three of the nicest, not only brightest, but three of the nicest people you'll ever meet. And what I'd like to start with, if it's okay with them, is just a little something personal, something fun they like to do out of work. And the reason I bring that up is sometimes we forget that the person on the other side of the phone or the email, we don't always agree with them. We don't always like what they say, but they're doing their best. They have their own rules. They're humans too. And hopefully we don't forget it. Sometimes people outside of this room forget that, but we have some really, really good, nice people here. And I think just to humanize everyone, maybe we could start, if you don't mind, Kathy, with you, something you do outside of work.
Hanging out with my grandchildren. I like spy novels and Hallmark movies.
How many grandchildren?
I have four, age 22 to 3.
Oh, wow, that's a lot. So, yeah, I'm all about family, too. I'm one of five siblings, and my husband's one of five siblings, and I have four children. So we have a lot of family get-togethers. That's always fun. My youngest is heading off to college, so I'm going to be an empty nester, and I'm going to be needing to find things to do.
Oh, you're going to be busy because Carlene is now branch chief of branch four.
Right. But, yeah, that mostly spending time with the family and being active outside, doing things outside. Love that.
Oh, for fun, I like to write comments on IRS regulations.
We are warped people.
All right, so now that you know that we actually have real humans up here, why don't we start with a little background? If you could each just describe your role, the structure of your office, maybe in Beth's case, your current role and former role as well with the government. So we'll maybe start with Kathy.
Okay, well, I am part of the Office of Tax Policy in the Treasury Department. We are headed by Assistant Secretary Lily Batchelder, who has a couple of deputy secretaries, but there are two main groups under her in OTP, Office of Tax Policy. There is the Office of Tax Analysis. Those are our economists and revenue estimators. And there is the Office of Tax Policy. That's divided into three sections. One is International Tax Council. These are the lawyers who negotiate our tax treaties and deal with international tax issues. Benefits Tax Council deals with employee benefits issues. And Tax Legislative Council, which is where I am, deals with all of the other sections of the code. There are probably 18 of us in TLC, and we work together very much as we work in a law firm. And one of the projects I'm working on, we have a partnership issue or an employee benefits issue. I walk down the hall, or now use Zoom, to talk to some of the people in BTC or somebody else in TLC. What we are charged with doing, we have two different functions. One is we are the technical tax advisors to the tax writing committees on the Hill. So sometimes we will get questions from the Hill saying, here's a draft of some legislation. This is what we want it to do. Does this work? We can't at that point tell them we don't like it. All we can say is, have you considered this? Or please don't do it this way because it's going to foul up this other section of the code. Maybe you can do it this way. That kind of thing. The other thing that we do a lot of is working with Carlene and the people in PNSI to develop guidance. We do not get, Treasury does not get involved in anything that is taxpayer specific, such as private letter rulings, which Carlene is going to talk about later. But anything else, we work very closely with Carlene and her group to develop that guidance. The other thing that we do every year is work on the administration's Green Book, which, as you know, is the administration's legislative wish list. Often we are developing the proposals. Sometimes we are told that we should write up certain proposals. But either way, we're heavily involved in the development of the Green Book. Carlene?
Okay. Yeah, as Justin said, I'm the branch chief of Branch 4 of the Pastors and Special Industries Division of the Office of Chief Counsel. Chief Counsel is part of the IRS, but the IRS is also our client, and we provide legal advice to the IRS. Chief Counsel's led by the Chief Counsel of the United States, which right now there's a nomination pending in the Senate for Marjorie Rawlinson. She has two deputies, one representing the operations side of the House, and that's Drita Tanuzzi. The operations side, they're primarily responsible for litigating all the tax court cases, tens of thousands of them every year. Those lawyers are around the country handling the tax court cases and also assisting examination. The technical side is led by the Deputy Chief Counsel, Bill Paul. And all of the six technical divisions are located in Washington, D.C., and this is what's referred to as the national office. So Pastors and Special Industries is one of those six technical divisions. It's led by Holly Porter, who's the Associate Chief Counsel. And then Branch 4 is one of those branches in Pastors and Special Industries, or PSI. PSI has a varied jurisdiction. In addition to estate and gift tax, there's special industries, as the name suggests, and also the income taxation of trusts and estates. That subject matter is not in Branch 4. That's in the pastors' branches, branches 1 and 3. So I've been branch chief since last December, but I've been a manager for about 10 years. And we have 12 attorneys in the branch total, including the managers, plus an intern right now. But we have the management team. We have two senior technician reviewers, which is Leslie Finlow and Dan Gespass. Leslie Finlow has been a manager for a long time, has a lot of experience. Dan Gespass joined us in 2018, and I think you'll be hearing from him tomorrow, actually, but from a firm in Pittsburgh. So it's been really nice to have the influx of outside practitioner experience in the branch because we've been able to hire more recently. Branch 4 also has two senior counsels who benefit the branch with their experience and leadership. And currently, the senior counsels are Melissa Lickerman, and also a new one that's about to start, John McKechnie. He's been in the branch a long time and has a ton of litigation support experience and field support. As far as my role in the role of Branch 4 of PSI, we are at the crossroads of tax administration. That's not my term, somebody else coined it, but it's totally true. We have very many stakeholders that we work with and that we provide advice to and also get information back from. I already mentioned the IRS is our client. We assist IRS exam, we assist estate tax attorneys, usually on their tough questions. A lot of times it's funneled through, it goes from IRS exam up to counsel, the field offices, and then if it's a technical question that they want national office help on, they'll bring it to our attention. We also get information from exam. They're the boots on the ground. And when we're implementing guidance, there's a group in IRS headquarters, the SBSC Estate and Gift Tax Policy Group, that we work closely with in thinking about administrability and of our rules. Field counsel or division counsel, that's another stakeholder. Like as I said, we work with them, we answer their technical questions. We also provide litigation support for some of the cases, not all the cases. There's a lot of valuation cases we never see. But if there's a technical issue, then oftentimes, especially if it's novel, we're gonna be involved providing litigation support. As Kathy said, we work a lot with Treasury and particularly Kathy at the Office of Tax Policy. We work closely and collaborate on guidance projects. We consider it kind of our working group. Kathy is part of that when we have guidance projects. So we work closely there. Sometimes we assist on Green Book proposals or provide some ideas. We also even collaborate on mundane things like forms and FAQs, just to make sure we're on the same page with some of that. We also work with taxpayers and the taxpayer representative community, such as groups like ACTEC. On an individual basis, we issue private letter rulings, which I'll talk about more later, but we also answer phone calls. I think it's a little known secret that you can just call us up. I mean, you would think our phone would be ringing all the time. I always think those are the smart people that just pick up the phone and give us a call. We also consider, so we hear from taxpayers as well. We hear from people like Beth that like to write comments on our regulations. So we consider that feedback, and we also, in the PGP process, when we solicit comments and suggestions for guidance, we also hear from practitioners in that event. We also work with other divisions within Chief Counsel, the national office. So I mentioned pastors and special industries. There's an income tax and accounting division, corporate, financial institutions and products, international, triple E, which I think it's employment tax, employee benefits, and exempt organizations. So we coordinate with those in every different type of way. So sometimes guidance requires coordination with those groups. Sometimes it might be a private letter ruling, and sometimes it might be litigation. So we also work with the Department of Justice, not as frequently, but for cases that are in the circuit court, district courts, or the appeals courts. Those cases are handled by Department of Justice, the refund cases, and if there's an issue that's kind of novel, that's something also we'll provide support with. And then finally, Congress is a stakeholder because we do respond to congressional inquiries, and we also sometimes respond to staff members that want to hear more about an issue. So you can see we have a lot of different diverse assignments, things that we work on. We're one of the largest law firms of in the country, with over 1,400 lawyers and counting, because we're hiring. So this is just a quick plug. We have an open announcement that's open for one more week. So if you know anybody that is that likes to geek out on tax, likes to write comments on the weekend, then that would be a great fit, because you really get the top issues.
You're trying to hire me? You're welcome back anytime.
That would be great, right. And I can tell you also, because I was asked this question last time, as for what we're looking for, I think we're looking at a diverse range of experience. We've got people applying right out of their LLM program, and we also have people applying with a lot of experience. And fortunately, we can hire more than one person, and I think both types of parts of the spectrum provide value to our branch, and so I think it's pretty wide open right now.
It'd be great experience for that young lawyer if they wanted to see the different perspective on tax administration.
Right.
The way that we work together is that IRS has the technical expertise. Not that I don't, I hope, but Treasury is supposed to bring the policy aspect to it. So it's a collaboration where we're trying to get to the right answer, both from a technical perspective and from a tax policy perspective.
Right.
So I had Kathy's job before Kathy had Kathy's job.
That's right. I'm Elizabeth II.
I guess I just want to talk a little bit about how being former government can launch a career, and what kind of involvement I still have with the government, as kind of an example of what one can get out of having some years of government service. So you can pass that along to all the people that who are considering applying for the jobs in Carlene's branch. So right now I am the national chair of the private client services practice at Lowenstein Sandler, which might be news to some of you. That just happened last month. And the way I'm still involved with the government is many faceted. One is that I do handle a lot of private letter rulings, and we're going to talk about that process in detail on this program. But I also still am involved with policy issues, because I love tax policy, and there are lots of opportunities to have continued involvement, most of which is very unofficial. I'll get a phone call from somebody on the Hill, and they'll say, Can you explain Thus and Such to us? Or how did we end up with this law? Or what do you think of this proposal that's in so-and-so's bill? And it's just an opportunity to have input. There's no client, there's no billing code, there's no direct benefit of any sort, but I love tax policy, and so when the phone rings, I just keep answering those questions, and I try to be as fair and even-handed as I can, but also to bring some practical considerations to whatever they're looking at, and hope to help make the laws better. I do like to comment when there are proposals that the IRS is seeking comments on. I think we should all be looking at those and putting in our two cents, because that's our opportunity to do so. I like to comment when the IRS is asking for suggestions of what kind of projects they ought to work on. A lot of that activity is through ACTEC, which takes a considerable involvement in these projects, which is a really good thing, because the IRS needs input from people in private practice. And then the last piece of it really is I still get lots of calls from the press, and that really all stems from my government service, because this person needs to be at Treasury, let's call her. And a lot of it's deep background, like, can you just explain to us how a GRAT works? Yeah, I can do that. And I can do it in a way that's straightforward and understandable by a layperson, because this person who's writing tax articles this week might have been writing, labor articles last week, and they don't really have a clue what they're looking at, and you got to break it down and make it understandable so that they can do it. So all of this is really by way of a pitch for government service, because if you do some years of government service, it benefits the government. The government benefits by having people come in from private practice with their experience and their knowledge, and then when you come out, I feel it pays off for the rest of your career, really.
Right.
All right. And if you're not already convinced, or your friends, to go try to apply for this job, if you're wondering if the grass is greener not having to bill your time, it is. All right, so with that, let's now move into the priority guidance plan for all the cool kids. It's called the PGP. So now that you know the cool abbreviation there, not quite as cool as the TLC that Kathy's group provides out of the TLC. But anyway, we've got this PGP priority guidance plan. Now, take a step back. We all should know how a bill becomes a law. There's a great Schoolhouse Rock song about it, I'm Just a Bill. There are no catchy songs about how tax guidance becomes official guidance. So I have a ton of questions for the group. I'm just going to throw them all out there, and then we'll have them answer it. So how does something become a priority, a quote-unquote priority on PGP? How do people outside the government, many of our attendees, how can they contribute? How do you sort through all the suggestions? How do you decide what to prioritize? Who drafts it? Who reviews it? Bunch of questions. Why don't we just, we've got a great order going. Kathy, why don't we start with you?
Okay, well, every year, as you know, we publish a notice asking for public comments as to what should be on the PGP. That notice was notice 2023-36. Comments were due June 9th, and we got comments. Thank you, ACTEC. The PGP is the document that the government uses, primarily the IRS uses, to manage their bandwidth in terms of what projects do we have the ability to work on. And usually the criteria is that the projects that are on the PGP for the coming year are the ones that we hope to be able to actually publish by the end of that guidance year. The guidance year ends on June 30th each year, although June sometimes has 60 or 90 days to it.
And is that kind of honored in the breach, Kathy?
Oh yeah, I mean that. We try. but these are the projects that we intend to really be putting most of our effort on, with a hope of actually getting these things published and out. Obviously, we are sometimes more successful than others in actually achieving that goal. But what we're looking for in terms of what projects get onto the PGP, first and foremost, if there has been a new piece of legislation enacted, that trumps everything else. We need to look at that piece of legislation, decide what guidance is needed to implement that legislation, and that always takes priority. We're also considering What are the internal needs of the IRS? Sometimes we get suggestions from the estate and gift tax policy group as to something that they've seen in practice and that they need help with. So internal needs for tax administration. Requests from the public. Often if IRS is getting a slew of private letter ruling requests on a particular topic, that may very well indicate that we need to do some guidance so that they don't have to be continually working on repetitive PLR requests on that issue. Litigation. Sometimes issues come up in litigation that we think would be appropriate to address in public guidance. And comments on an NPRM. As I think many of you have heard me say many times, when you see that we're working on a project, when something appears on the PGP, don't wait until we've issued a notice of proposed rulemaking, proposed regs, to come in with comments. If there's something that you think we should be considering as part of work on that project, let us know before we publish the proposed regs. Because what happens is sometimes we get a comment during the comment period that we really like, but we didn't propose it in the proposed regs, so we can't include it in the final regs. We would have to open a new guidance project to address that comment and to do something about it. So when you see the PGP, if there's a particular fact situation that you think we ought to be thinking about, let us know. That would be very helpful. So what we're looking at is identifying a problem, what problems really can we help with guidance of various types? Are these problems that are going to affect a lot of people or just one or two people, in which case, you know, we have a higher priority, the size of the affected group of taxpayers. We go through every comment we have received and try and prioritize them and then match it to the bandwidth that is available in the service at that point. If you have made a request and made a suggestion for a project to be included on the PGP and you keep seeing it being ignored, not appearing on the PGP, don't give up. Keep asking. There are a lot of times when we like a project, we want to do a project, but there are higher priorities, and it may be 2 or 3 years before that project makes it onto the PGP. In addition, there are projects that we don't think we can publish by the end of that June 30th. So there are things that we are working on that don't make it onto the PGP. So there are a lot of ways that we address things. So don't give up. If you haven't seen your project addressed, keep asking.
Right. Yeah, and that's true. With the local list, I think that Kathy mentioned, I mean, that's something we don't advertise, but just because it's not on the priority guidance plan doesn't mean we're not working on it. So there's some things that come that are added to the plan 1 year and then they disappear. That again doesn't mean that it's that we're not working on it, but it does mean that maybe it's other items have increased priority, or we don't have the bandwidth to get to it that year. And also new suggestions. If there's a new suggestion that's submitted through the PGP process, we might really like the idea, and it might be that we can open up a project to start working on it, but we don't expect that we're going to get it out that year. So it may be that we have adopted that comment, but it's not being shown to the public yet because it's really not ready for prime time. And but it might come on in a subsequent year once work's been able to be done on it and we've got an idea that it's going to work.
And a lot of times we get questions as to, well, how do you know what kind of guidance you're going to produce on a particular project? And often we don't know when we start a project what kind of guidance we're going to be putting out. Obviously, a reg needs to be subject to notice and comment. We had that discussion yesterday about the APA. Regulations get deference, at least under current law. So there's a reg. It depends on the issue as to whether we think this is an issue on which there should be deference. There are revenue rulings, which is the IRS's take on the application of law to a particular set of facts. There are revenue procedures, which deal with procedures, and often we can offer safe harbors in a revenue procedure. And there are notices. And there's been a lot of talk in recent years about whether we should be doing notices or whether we should be doing everything with notice and comment. But often we use notices if someone needs guidance quickly, because obviously regs are not a quick process. And we use notices to get information out that we think taxpayers and practitioners need on a hurry-up basis. There was one example of that was in the ABLE Act, the 529A provisions. We were hearing a lot from the different state agencies that administer ABLE programs that in order to implement the statute and to get their programs up and running, there were a couple of issues that they really needed to have nailed down before we were going to be able to get regulations out. So we took a fairly unusual approach in issuing a notice saying that with regard to those three particular issues, this is what we intend to say in proposed regulations so that they could start doing the programming that they needed to do to get their programs up and running. So that's typically what we would use a notice for.
Right. And I guess I'd just share an example of, you know, the internal internal suggestions. And since one is on the PGP for this past year, which was the regulations, the QDOT regulations, so under 2056 Cap A, that was something that started out as I said, the information sharing with SBSC, Estate and Gift Tax Policy, that headquarters function. You know, they came to us and showed us the problem that they're having with the regulations that give very specific instructions about where to send different things to, that those offices no longer exist or they've been moved, but it's in a regulation. So, you know, they came to us, how do we fix this? Can we do some other type of guidance? And, you know, here we've got, because it's in a regulation, it's something that we felt needed a regulation to change. Maybe the next ones won't be as specific.
Yeah, the new address will not be in the new
regulation. Yeah, the new one, right. But we did suggest that they make that suggestion through when the PGP process came through, and that sure enough, it showed up as one of their suggestions, and we thought it would be something that we could turn around pretty quickly since it's not really substantive. So that one did make it to the PGP.
Do you want to talk about the reg development and clearance process? Beth, do you have anything you want to say?
Yeah, just let me say two things. One is I really do want to encourage people to send in suggestions when the IRS puts out the annual notice that says we're looking for projects for the PGP. And what I find is if you wait until you see that notice to think about what you wanted to suggest, you won't remember what it was that irritated you during the past year. So just, you know, on some scrap of paper someplace, as you just do your daily work, write down things where you think we're missing guidance and where it would be really useful to have a notice or a rev proc or rev ruling or proposed regs, and just keep your own private list of those. And then when the request comes out saying, do you have any suggestions, you don't need to be ACTEC or the ABA or the AICPA to send in suggestions. You can just be you, and they make it really easy to send these in. They're all electronic. You just click on it and upload it, and then they will read it. Right. And think about it.
And discuss it.
And if there are, you know, if there's something where we're missing guidance and a lot of people have that on their little list and they send it in, that gives it more importance because they go, oh, actually, look, a number of people are saying this is something we should be issuing guidance on. Maybe we should consider doing it.
Right.
The other thing I was going to throw in before we leave this topic is there's one project that has kind of an interesting, took an interesting route to the priority guidance plan that's kind of unusual, so I thought I would just kind of mention that one. And that's the project that culminated in Revenue Ruling 2023-2 having to do with grantor trusts. And that's been kind of a one-man campaign by Representative Pascrell from New Jersey. And every time Janet Yellen testifies before the House Ways and Means, he gets up there and says, what are you doing about grantor trusts? And then there's this letter he wrote on March 8th, 2022 to Secretary Yellen, and he says, the most glaring loophole in today's income tax base is the ability of heirs to obtain tax-free, stepped-up basis on appreciated assets they inherit on the death of a taxpayer. And then he goes on, okay, so that's, I mean, all right, it's a big tax expenditure item that we give people a step-up in basis at death. But then he says, Testimony for the record of our hearing has brought to my attention that in recent years, more aggressive estate planners have taken the position that the termination of an irrevocable trust at the death of a grantor should be treated as a bequest or devise under Code Section 1014B1. And he harped on that so much that Secretary Yellen said, yes, yes, we're going to do something about it. And then, you know, she'd be testifying as something else. And he'd say, when are you going to do something about this? And she's like, soon, soon. So then the next thing that happens is we get the priority guidance plan, and it says, guidance regarding availability of Section 1014 basis adjustment at the death of the owner of a grantor trust described in Section 671 when the trust assets are not included in the owner's gross estate for estate tax purposes. So in this case, it took what I'm going to blatantly call a fringe position and escalated it to national prominence, forced its way onto the priority guidance plan, and now we have the answer, for those who didn't already know the answer, in Revenue Ruling 2023-2, that no, you don't get a stepped-up in basis for grantor trust assets that are not included in the estate, with a little footnote that I call the Ellen Harrison footnote that pertains to some international issues. But that's a really unusual way to get to the priority guidance plan, but these things happen.
And actually, I have to say, that was on our radar before Representative Pascrell started waving his flag, but in any event, we finally did get it out.
Okay. And I bet Secretary Yellen's really glad.
Oh, it made her day. Yes, made her day. This was a big issue. Let's talk a little bit about what the process is for clearing a regulation. For the other kind of guidance that we work on that is not published in the Federal Register, it's not quite so complicated. For example, for a revenue ruling or a revenue procedure, it goes up through Carlene as branch chief to Holly Porter as the associate chief counsel of PNSI. From there, it goes to the chief counsel for clearance. Then it goes to the commissioner's office for clearance. Then it comes to us at Treasury. I sign off on it. It goes to my boss. It goes to Lily. It goes back to IRS, and it's published. Regs are a lot more complicated, takes a lot more time. We go through that same process, but once it comes to Treasury and it goes past Lilly, it has to go through the Executive Secretariat Office at the Treasury Department. It has to go through our General Counsel. And until 3 weeks ago, it had to go through OIRA as well. We have just gotten, as of June 9th, I believe, a new memorandum of agreement with the Office of Management and Budget saying that Treasury regs no longer have to be reviewed by OIRA. So that will make that step a little easier.
Do you want to tell people what OIRA stands for?
I always have to look it up.
Interregulatory.
It's the, wait a minute. I brought it with me so I would know, because I always forget. It's the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs. Is that it?
If I knew the answer, I would be helping you.
Okay.
It's close.
Hang on.
It's an executive branch group, right?
I brought it with me. Yes, it is part of the Office of Management and Budget in the Executive Office of the President. So it comes under the White House, and their charge is to review all executive branch regulations, essentially to make sure that it's not an unnecessary burden on taxpayers, that it's consistent with the administration policy, that sort of thing. So the original MOA was requiring us to submit all regulations to OIRA for their review, and if it was a significant reg, which was defined in a couple of different ways, it affected more than a certain amount of money in the economy, or was a significant enough issue on a policy basis. Part of the presentation in the reg itself and to OIRA had to be a significant analysis done by our economists and revenue estimators as to what we're doing, what we needed to do, what was the economic effect of the regulation. It was a lot of work.
And so, all of that was relatively new, right? Didn't that come in the last 6 years or so?
Yes.
Yeah.
But we now have a new memorandum of agreement so that their review of our treasury regs are going to be not as detailed, not as much work for our economists. Most of the regulations that I work on were not significant according to their standards, so none of the regs I worked on ever had to go through that process with significant work by the economists. But
we think your regs are really significant.
I'm so glad. So anyway, for a lot of regs, it will make a significant difference. So that was just signed in June, the beginning of June. What happens when we put out a proposed regulation, as you know, to make Beth happy, we ask for comments. The whole purpose of guidance, obviously, is to make things clearer and easier and avoid litigation for both taxpayers and the service. So the more input we have, the better job we can do, the better the guidance is going to be, the more helpful it's going to be, and the better we can reach that goal. So your comments are really, really, really important. ACTEC uniformly provides really valuable comments. What makes a really valuable comment, in my view, is you identify the issue that's the problem, explain why it's a problem, who it affects, how many people it affects, and how it comes up, and suggest a solution or an alternative. Those are really, really, really helpful. ACTEC never does some things that other commenters ask us to do, like change the statute. We can't do that. You know, we're stuck with the statute. We have to implement what we're given. But you wouldn't believe the number of comments that come in that ask us to change the statute.
Kathy, do you like it when we suggest examples? Is that helpful?
Yes, I think it is helpful.
Okay. You don't feel insulted if we do that?
Absolutely not. Okay. No, absolutely not. Okay. So the more thoughtful the comments are, the better the reg is going to be, and we very much appreciate that. We get a lot of comments that are not at ACTEC's level of helpfulness, and I want to read you one of my favorites. This one came in response to the proposed regulations under Section 2010 last summer, dealing with the exception to the clawback regulations when dealing with the change in the basic exclusion amount. This was submitted by Anonymous Squared, which is always a clue that it's going to be an interesting comment. This is the comment. It's two short paragraphs. I recommend we tax estate and gift taxes at 90%. When I try to read this, it is all legal speak, but my gut feeling is the rich need to pay a lot more tax. We know the rich and businesses cheat on their taxes because their lackeys, the Republicans, tweak the laws that enable the rich to win at the tax game. Meanwhile, the middle class provide $4 trillion of tax revenue annually to the government. This is why crooks, grifters, con men, realtors, developers, and other corrupt business people want to be politicians. They are going to award trillions of dollars to themselves, friends, families, and business partners. Meanwhile, the Republicans are preparing to let Social Security dry up. When Trump and the Republicans got the majority, the first and only thing they did was to give themselves a tax cut. Contrastly, when Biden and the Democrats got in there, they passed an infrastructure bill. We need to rebalance and give the middle class a future, tax the rich and their heirs to the max. Now, I know we listened to a long presentation yesterday about the APA, but I got to tell you, it's really hard to respond to this kind of a comment.
But I just want to point out, in fairness, that these types of comments are not restricted to either end of the political spectrum.
Oh, totally.
And yeah. Back when there were proposed regulations under 2704, if I recall correctly, you received over 10,000 comments on those regulations. And we all know that there aren't 10,000 people on this planet who even halfway understand Section 2704. So if you looked at those, I think that something like 9,990 of them said, you should repeal the estate tax.
Yeah. Most of them were postcards.
Yeah. So the comments, in other words, are not always germane. But right. I think that just makes Kathy and Carlene appreciate ACTEC all the more.
Right. Yes. Thank you.
And I think we have a little leeway. Like Kathy said, we consider every comment, even these ones. We get, at least get some entertainment out of it. But we also attempt to respond and address the comments in the preamble to the reg. But
I would love to see you respond to the crazy comments. That's my idea.
I feel like we have a little
leeway. Make the preamble
leeway.
A lot more interesting. But you
right,
know,
right.
You should be rewarding those of us who read preambles.
Right. Well, I think with those we just try to avoid. I think we have some leeway there.
Well, we say they're beyond the scope.
Beyond
of the
scope, right.
We received 10,000 comments that were beyond the scope of the regulation.
Exactly.
But in terms of the process, I mean, we do read, even these, we read every single comment. We discuss every single comment, and there is a process that we all go through individually and as a group, where once we have a draft of the final reg and the draft of the preamble, we go through to make sure the preamble accurately reflects what we're saying in the final reg, and that the preamble responds to every comment, other than these, and explains what the comment was, what we did in response, and why. Right. So we routinely try very hard to satisfy right. the APA requirements that were discussed yesterday, and we do that in the normal course.
Right. And sometimes it's not easy to understand a comment. Like Kathy said, they're not all, you know, at ACT Tech level. And so sometimes there's just, it's a few sentences suggesting an issue and you're stuck trying to interpret what they meant. So, and you know, it's not entirely clear. So when you asked Beth about examples, I think it's always helpful to provide example. Like maybe, you know, maybe it's not as clear the comment as the writer thinks it is, and an example would really kind of illustrate what your the issue is that you're pointing out.
And obviously, sometimes we have hearings on these proposed regulations. In which case, our role is to listen. We're not going to be able to tell you what we're going to do or what we think. It's not a discussion, but we listen. And a lot of times, we get extra understanding of where the commenters were coming from and what the comment was intended to convey.
Right. Well, you don't just listen, you also ask questions.
Yes.
Because you probe, that's an ability to probe the comment, and if it's not clear what the comment is, you can ferret that out in that process.
Right. Exactly. Okay. We get to ask questions. And we've recently issued an announcement saying that now tax hearings on proposed regulations will all be in person now. There will be an accommodation if someone needs to participate by Zoom, but we're back to in-person hearings.
Right. That's going to be nice.
All right, I'll just give another reminder to the group, and that is if you haven't already participated through ACT Tech or otherwise in that comment process, I'd highly recommend it. It's really neat when the final or starts with proposed regs and the final regs come out and the government agrees with you and you see your example. It's very easy to explain to clients and colleagues because you wrote it. So make their lives easy. And they're a real good partner. That's really what they're looking for is, can we make their lives easier? I'll even give you a recent example. You know, what happens to excess deductions after the termination of a trust or an estate? That came from a big project. You're going to see a lot of familiar things in the final reg that started at the ACT Tech level. But we've got this priority guidance plan, although sometimes we get this official guidance and it doesn't initially show up on the priority guidance plan, or sometimes it kind of shows up after the fact. So how does that happen? And Carlene, maybe we'll start with you with that one.
Okay, sure. Kathy already mentioned legislation's a big reason why something could just appear on the PGP when it wasn't on there on the initial plan. That happened, it happened with IRA, but also the Transportation Act and from 2015, the consistent basis requirement and reporting that required immediate guidance. So once it was issued, then it's added afterwards. The first focus is getting the guidance out. And then once it's released or published, then it would be added to the PGP. Another example happened last year, about a year ago, when we issued Revenue Procedure 2022-32. This was the portability DSU relief, the simplified procedures for electing portability. And this, I guess I'll go through a little bit of the history of that. We as you know, portability new is from 2011. A lot of people didn't know about it. If you want to be able to take advantage of portability, you have to file an estate tax return, even if there's no filing requirement. So estates that formerly had no reason to file an estate tax return now are tasked with filing that estate tax return if they want to secure the benefit of portability. So we're finding that, and we were hearing that from the practitioner community for years, that this is what people didn't understand this, and we had issued some different levels of relief over the years, with the last one being in 2017, which provided, in addition to a grace period, it also provided a two-year window from the date of death to file that return using the simplified procedures, and it would be considered timely, and the election would be timely, and there would be no need to request a private letter ruling, which would be the other option. Again, this is only for estates that don't have a filing requirement. There's no portability relief if there is a filing requirement. But we saw that in the past couple of years, the numbers were increasing even after the 2017 guidance. It was kind of the number one request, PLR request, that we were seeing in the branch. In 2021, we had received 94 requests, which was an increase from the year before. Again, I told you there's 12 of us in the branch, right? So then in 2022, we saw this trend continuing. Like, so last year, the beginning of the year, and I think it has to do with the sunset of the basic exclusion amount. People are going to their practitioners. They're realizing, I didn't know about this, and now it's something I want to do. So there was a 60% increase we were seeing from the year before, and so we are on pace to have 152 requests if we kept on that pace last year. So, we had looked at that data. We looked at the data of the requests that were in-house and the period of time from which the first spouse died to when they were discovering the issue, and we realized that about 90% were within the five-year period. So then, as kind of we've talked about, our process is to kind of collaborate with SBSC, Estate and Gift Tax Policy, so and Treasury, Kathy at OTP. So we contacted them and were asked if there were any administrability issues, and we kind of settled on this five-year period, and we were able to get it out really quickly, and it was issued last July. So that was kind of something nice to see that we could do very quickly. There was a lot of support for it because they saw the burden that it was putting on the branch. And we were able to issue like dozens, maybe 60 refunds after we issued that revenue procedure. And I just looked, and so far we've received 12 this year. So we're on a pace for about two dozen, which is definitely much more doable.
It's a way better use of resources.
Right. I mean, we had all those numbers, and if you've ever seen them, they're all the same letter. So the work is not really in the letter, but it is a big drain on resources because we process them the same as we do any other 9100. And I'll talk more about that later, but there's a lot of requirements for 9100s, and those still apply even with the DSUs.
This was really a win-win because, you've made clear how it was a win from the IRS perspective in terms of saving resources. It's also a win from the taxpayer perspective because it's much easier to do the simplified filing, and you don't have to pay any filing fees, and it's faster. And this was a great idea.
All right, great. Let's keep moving on. So we've talked about regulations, revenue rulings, revenue procedures, priority guidance plan. But what about technical advice memoranda? We have our TAMs. Where do those come from? So Beth, maybe we'll start with you on that one.
Okay. So when you're researching private letter rulings, you'll notice that some of them that look like private letter rulings actually say on the top that they are TAMs or technical advice memoranda. And the question is, where do those come from? We're going to talk in kind of backwards order here. I guess we'll talk about the private letter ruling process after we talk about TAMs. But a TAM reads a lot like a private letter ruling, but its origins are completely different. And it's also similar to a private letter ruling in that it applies to a particular taxpayer. But instead of it being the case where the taxpayer and their representative have come into the national office saying, can I get advice on this, a TAM originates in the examination process. So the request, it's a request for assistance by the people in the field, the IRS agents in the field, on any kind of technical or procedural question that comes up during the process of an audit. And the field usually will request a TAM when the application of the law to the facts is unclear in their view. It can be a question on the interpretation or application of any legal authority. It's not something that's going to be prospective or hypothetical because it's arising in the course of an examination. So a taxpayer can suggest to exam that they ask for a TAM, but it's exam's decision whether or not to actually request an exam, a TAM. These things all rhyme. There's food for you here, Justin.
Yes.
If you don't read Justin's LinkedIn postings, you really should, because they often have poetry in them. So here's source material for you, Justin. Taxpayer participation in the TAM process is preferred according to Revenue Procedure 2023-2. I don't know why you would ever not participate if you were invited by exam to participate. So the government may prefer you to participate, but I think you absolutely should participate. The TAM process can't be used for something that really needs 9100 relief. That's a different route to the national office. It can't be used for frivolous issues. It can't be used in docketed cases. So again, it's up to the field whether to go ahead and ask the national office for advice. But if the taxpayer suggests it and the field says, we don't think we need their advice, there is an appeal process by which the taxpayer can ask again at a higher level over the individual examiner's head, can we please go to the national office for advice on this? If you end up going to the national office on a TAM, there is a mandatory pre-submission conference. You'll see in a minute that for private letter rulings, the pre-submission conference is optional, but in a TAM, it's mandatory. And then the process is that the field and the taxpayer exchange proposed statements of pertinent facts and the issues. You include any facts that are in dispute. You include a legal analysis, supporting authorities. And then when it goes to the national office and they look at it, they might have other questions that aren't raised in those submissions, and they can add those questions to the pool of what's being considered. Another question that comes up in this is, well, hey, wait, there are these other things that I see called chief counsel advice, CCAs. What are those? And a CCA is different from a TAM in that you can see in a TAM there's all this taxpayer involvement, and so you get both sides put before the national office. The CCA is just the chief counsel's advice on something, and the taxpayer doesn't get the opportunity to participate and sometimes doesn't even know that it's happening. So I've been involved in cases where I don't remember if it was in examination or in appeals, but they went for advice from Branch 4, and I didn't even know it until the advice had been issued. So that's yet another type of process that involves taxpayers and the national office.
Right. So TAMS, GLAMS. GLAMS is another rhyming thing for Justin.
But I thought that was a type of camping.
Well, that's glamping, right. But no, GLAMS are general legal advice memos, and I'm not really sure if it's the same thing as a non-taxpayer-specific CCA, because CCAs can be taxpayer-specific, as in Beth's experience, but they can also just be non-taxpayer-specific, where advice is asked on a particular issue, and there's just generic facts made up. So with the taxpayer-specific CCAs, the taxpayer may not find out until it's about to be issued, and I think that at that point that there would be a heads up as far as taxpayer identifiers and giving them a chance to redact and so forth. But yeah, very different processes, and as Beth mentioned.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you, but not input. And so
no.
It's important to remember when you're reading a CCA, that is the IRS's position. That's not the result of, back and forth and argument and kind of the right. Conclusion after it's hearing both sides. It's just a statement of the IRS's position.
on the facts that were provided by exam, you know, as well.
And often on something that's headed towards litigation.
Right.
All right, sort of our last big topic. Sometimes our clients, we need an answer, but the tax rules are unclear. I don't know if any of you have ever had that experience. No, so we read the code, we read the regulations, we read the revenue procedures, the revenue rulings, we read these TAMs and CCAs, and we still don't have an answer. It's a very important issue. So fortunately, we have this whole letter ruling process, but it brings up questions, sort of, how do you determine what you're gonna rule, what you will or won't rule on? What about suggestions or recommendations? How do we make this letter ruling process as successful as possible? So Carlene, this might be
sure.
A good one to start
okay.
with you.
Yeah, that sounds good. Yep, as we mentioned, you can request private letter rulings on the taxpayer specific set of facts. It's only gonna be binding on the service with respect to that taxpayer. Even though there's always a caveat that it can't be cited as precedent, I know that they're reported and people do definitely look at those. The National Office Technical Divisions are assigned these requests and issue the rulings. As for determining what we'll rule on, I think Justin may have provided the materials, Revenue Procedure 2023-1 and -3, they're always the first and third revenue procedures of the year that those are relevant to the transfer tax gift rulings. There's some other revenue procedures that might deal with some income tax issues, but the first and the third are you know, kind of guide this process, and they're very long. They're very uninteresting. They're 100 pages, over 100 pages, but it does give you all the rules as to what we'll rule on and what we won't rule on. So as far as just the transfer tax area, it tells you that we'll rule in gift tax matters, estate tax matters, generation skipping transfer tax matters, and 9100 requests. Typically, they're looking at proposed transactions or for gift, for the prospective estate of a living person for estate tax matters. Same thing with GST, but these are all general rules. There are, something that if you're not sure, you could come in for a pre-submission conference, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But those are the general categories. And then as far as what we won't rule on, that's also covered in these revenue procedures. The -1 rule ruling revenue procedure has general categories of issues that we won't rule on. So nothing specific. You know, they have rules in there that says not if the request is under examination, and that's ordinarily, because we will issue 9100 rulings even if it's an exam or in appeals or even in litigation. It's happened. So. But the general rule is that ordinarily we won't issue rulings in that situation. Then there's a rule that we won't rule with in certain factual areas because of the factual nature of the problem or for other reasons. And some of these are specifically identified later in the third revenue ruling that identify the certain factual scenarios that we've determined we're not going to rule on. But it could just be germane to that one case that maybe this is a best handled by exam. There's too many factual issues that need to be considered or to obtained before we can rule. But we can always decline to rule when appropriate in the interest of sound tax administration. So that kind of gives discretion depending on, it can take into account resource constraints or on any other grounds when warranted by the facts and circumstances. So for instance, we don't rule, there's one example is we don't rule in request for relief. It's not our practice to rule. This is not stated in -3, but it's not our practice to rule in request for relief under 2642G to allocate GST exemption if the donor's already opted out of the automatic allocation of GST exemption for the transfer to the trust. And this is just something that we've had this come in. We've got proposed rules out there that kind of take a different position. And until we issue final rules, it kind of comes under that exception that we won't issue rulings when it's under proposed, when there's a rule that needs to be published. Another reason we won't rule our categories when it's part of an integrated transaction and you're only asking for a ruling on part of it. This is the anti-cherry picking of rule here. And that's just, you know, you might if somebody comes in for a ruling on a division of trust where there's an income tax issue, but they don't ask for the income tax issue, that might be something where we won't rule unless you also take the income tax issue, which might be adverse, even though the other one is favorable. And finally, there's another one, which is when the ruling has to, the requester for the private letter ruling the issue has to affect the tax status of the requester. So, for instance, if this has happened before, where someone's come in and asked if they qualified for, it was a fraternal organization, and they wanted a ruling that donations to it would qualify under 2055A3. So, we couldn't rule for them to that taxpayer because it wasn't related to their tax liability under 2055. But they were welcome to bring, if there was a donor that wanted to make that request, the donor could come in and request that letter. And then, as I mentioned, the 2023-3 revenue procedure, they identify the specific areas, no rule areas, and Section 3.01 goes over the areas in which PLRs will not be issued, so no discretion there. We're not going to issue a ruling. And an example of that one is when there's a trust that whether the trust will retain its GST exempt status, and this factual scenario is very similar to one of the examples in our regulations under 2601-1B4IE. So if there's an example, and there is one of like a division of trust, and your factual scenario is very similar, we're not going to rule on that. It's not a good use of resources.
Commonly known as a comfort ruling, right?
Yes, that would be a good example of a comfort ruling. And then there's Section 4.01 identifies areas in which the PLRs will not ordinarily be issued. So that means we do have some discretion if it brings up maybe a novel issue. But one example is a blessing of the whole charitable remainder trust. So that's basically, it comes in different sections, but under 664, 2055, if you're asking, will my transfer to this CRT qualify me for a deduction under 2055, that's too broad. We're not going to rule on that. But if you ask about a specific provision that you're concerned about or that you had a question about that you wanted us to weigh in on, that is something that we might entertain a ruling on.
Which category does decanting fall into?
I think that's a not ordinarily.
Okay.
That's a not ordinarily be issued, yeah. I believe that it is. And then Section 05 is areas under study. Actually, it might be under study.
I think it's under study.
I think it's under study, yeah. That's right. So,
since 2011.
Yeah. Yes.
We work really hard.
There's a lot of studying.
There's a lot of studying. Right. A lot. Right. Exactly. I mean, you know, yes, there are things in this list that that have been on there for a long, long time. I think 1014 was on that list, so at least that one's coming off. But we also add some. We go through that process every year, and if there's some to add, then we'll add them. I mean, it's not something we do every year, but if there's something that came up that we thought would be should be on that list, then we would put it in there. Then as far as suggestions or recommendations for help with the letter ruling process, one is understanding the most common ruling areas. We've gone over some. There's 9100 relief. There's relief under 2642G. For generation skipping transfer tax allocations and elections. There's a lot of rulings that we issue that are come in for the estate gift and GST consequences of modifications to a trust. So we see that a lot. Grandfather trust under 2601 or just zero inclusion ratio trusts. And also the CRTs, like I mentioned, surprisingly, those come up a lot. We at Branch 4 has joint jurisdiction with the pastor's branches, so a lot of times we will coordinate with each other on those, and one of us will take prime on that. But I think the most helpful thing is pre-submission conferences, or even before that, just picking up the phone and calling. Maybe you're not sure if your request it would merit a whole pre-submission conference. You could just try calling somebody. And then they can kind of point you in the right direction as to whether we should set up something more formal. When you call somebody, you're just going to get, you know, an attorney in the branch. A pre-submission conference will have a docket attorney assigned with a reviewer. And we will look at what's submitted. Let me go through the requirements. I mean, to have a pre-submission conference, they are free. There's no user fee, but you do need to identify the taxpayer, and the taxpayer must intend to submit a request. You have to provide the 2848, of course, and you need to provide a write-up of the proposed transaction, the issue, and the legal analysis. And you know, the docket attorney will call, set up the conference, and we'll just kind of discuss the substantive issues a little bit, and also any kind of give any tips or advice for what you can do for submitting that request, so that it comes in ready and we can give it our attention without needing additional information, because that definitely slows things down. However, just when you have a pre-submission conference, the information discussed is advisory only, and nothing's binding on the service. So someone comes in and tells you, oh, this transaction looks great, just set it in, and then it's assigned maybe to the same attorney, maybe to someone else, and they come to a different conclusion. That's totally, it doesn't happen often, but that could happen.
But the real benefit of the pre-submission conference is that you can get feedback as to focusing the issue for the service.
Right.
And getting tips as to how to structure the request when it does come in, right?
Right, right. Yeah, and one of the no rule areas, which I might have skipped, was a hypothetical. If you're coming in and you want to maybe do something a certain way, for a private letter ruling, you have to come in with, this is what we want to do, what do you think? For a pre-submission conference, it's the same. You would come in and say, this is what we want to do, but you kind of have a little, that opportunity to kind of see how it looks. And, it's not infrequent that people go back and make some changes to what they were going to do. And so that when it comes in, it's kind of better set up to be favorable.
And I think the decision of whether to go for a pre-submission conference is a strategic decision. And you need to kind of weigh the pros and cons in your particular situation in deciding whether you want that kind of early preview of the IRS's view or whether you don't want it.
Yeah.
Do you have an example in mind? As to when you wouldn't want it?
So I think sometimes in the pre-submission conference you get a, well, obviously because they haven't studied the issue, you get a less thorough examination of the issue. And if it's an issue that really is a complex issue that's going to require a lot of consideration, I don't think there's as much benefit from it because they're not, understandably, the IRS is not going to devote a lot of hours to preparing for your pre-submission conference. They're not going to have all the information in front of them, and you haven't asked for a ruling yet. And so I think that there are certain complicated issues that you're better off just diving in and asking for the ruling.
Yeah, and that's a good point because there's no time limits for a pre-submission conference. We try to get to them without delay as best we can, but the private letter ruling process is governed by a time frame. We aim to get those out within 4 to 6 months. With a pre-submission conference, I would say, it's not written in the revenue procedure, but we try to get to those as quickly as we can, much shorter than 4 to 6 months. But if something comes in that is very complicated or a very tough issue, it is going to be something that has to kind of get back burnered because it takes more time to get into that and there's other work to do. So it could slow down, in that situation.
And I'll give an example on the other end of the spectrum. Like if I have something that I don't know whether the IRS is going to consider it a comfort ruling or whether it's something they would rule on, and I don't want the client to go to the expense of having a full ruling prepared only to find out that it's not, to be considered a comfort ruling, that's a place where it's really beneficial to have the pre-sub conference because then Carlene can say, well, we would consider that a comfort ruling, and then it won't have cost the client, a ton of money to get to that point.
Right. So other helpful tips, I guess there is a checklist that's actually required to be submitted with a request, but you know, it's a quicker reference than the 100 plus pages that, you know, that you'll face with the revenue procedure. There's also a checklist for estate and gift PLRs that is in 9114. And that one, it's really just a reminder about adding copies of wills and trusts and gift transfer documents. So it's not as burdensome as the one in the revenue regular revenue procedure. Another tip is just user fees, being aware of them, being aware. There's an appendix that tells you all the different user fees, and the taxpayer is entitled to the lowest user fee that's applicable to that taxpayer. So there's a standard user fee, then there's a 9100 user fee, and then even less than that, there's a reduced user fee for based on different income limitations. So so just be mindful of that. Also, we get, you know, in branch four, a lot of husband and wives come in, or partners come in, and ask for rulings, maybe consenting to split the gifts, and they don't realize that a second fee is needed. So, you know, with these are two separate taxpayers, and that's the way the revenue procedure is drafted, that so they each need their own letter. And that would be a separate user fee, but the partner would have a reduced user fee as for a substantially identical ruling. Another thing I'd like to talk about is 9100s, because we get so many of those, and often the attorneys need to go back and get additional information. So I think the biggest thing is the way I look at it is telling the whole story. And the regulations under 9100 really instruct you to tell the whole story. There's the requirement that the taxpayer submit an affidavit. Sometimes that's all we get, is the taxpayer saying, here's what happened, and you know, I didn't know about it, or I wasn't advised of it, and that's it. But the regulations under 9100 actually ask for a lot more than that. So anybody that had knowledge, anyone that had knowledge or that helped or advised the taxpayer, the accountant, any of those people would need to submit an affidavit. If you're the advisor that comes in and discovers the missed election, we need your affidavit as well. So remember that.
The way I think of it is anybody who touched it needs to write
anyone
an affidavit.
That touched it, right, exactly. And to address what's requested of it. So, you know, there's some specific rules in there, so just pay attention to that. One other thing for 9100 DSUs, we request a draft Form 706, and that's really because it's the only way we have authority to issue those is if there is no filing requirement. So the draft Form 706 is a good way to show that. And I've already gone over the time frames, the 4 to 6 month target date. Being aware of that is good so that you can follow up. One more thing is the 21-day call. You should get a call within 20, an attorney is supposed to call you within 21 days of getting the assignment. They may not get it right away, so if you don't hear from somebody on and you've submitted your case 30 or 40 days before, then you can go ahead and call me, call my branch, and we can track it down for you. And I think that's it. There's one more tip, I guess, automatic relief provisions. They're also in the appendix, but there's some that you can use without having to come in for a letter ruling.
Wow, that was a lot in a one breath.
Yeah.
Well, we're running close to time. If you do have questions, please come up during the break. Happy to help there. We've noticed from the feedback forms, which we once again encourage you to fill out, the closer we end on time, the better the reviews are.